Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to go ahead and get this party started. I mean this AA meeting. I do want to welcome all of you here tonight to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Catherine, and I am an alcoholic. And for those of you who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. And the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all of you gathered here this evening. Now, these premises are non-smoking, so if you do want to smoke, please go outside and move away from the door. There's a little butt can that's kind of out past the bike rack, so please make sure you use the butt can and stay away from the front door. Our group's welcome to be in this room and the restrooms exclusively. The restrooms are right outside this door up a small flight of stairs. There's a big banner that says restrooms. And at this time, please silence your cell phones. Just make sure they're turned off. And we ask respectfully that everyone here tonight, please remain seated during the meeting. This will help everyone hear our wonderful speakers here with us tonight. Our group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a clear set of directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. And these actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of the meeting tonight is an open big book step study discussion. And as a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. So with that, I would like to announce our two speakers who have been so nice to be with us tonight. We have Johnny and BJ, both from Norfolk. So let's welcome them. Wow, you really drew up the applause. All right, so tonight we're on the second part of step one. And we're going to be beginning on page 51. And step one is that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And we'll go ahead and read out of the big book for a couple of chapters or paragraphs, and then our guest speakers will share a little bit on their experience with what we're discussing. And we're on page 5. Not page 15. Page 5. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not so much take it. I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone.
In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did.
Hi, I'm Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 25th, 2013. I have a home group. It's Friday Nooners, whereas as Bill sees it. We're on Friday at noon, and I cannot remember to save my life what the name of the church is. But it's in the directory. Oh, there you go. I was a bartender on Granby Street. I've been hired and fired from almost every bar on it. And there were times when I really enjoyed drinking, and I had a lot of fun with it. And I had two friends. They were friends of mine my entire life, my adult life anyway. They were my college roommates, and one had gotten divorced and moved back here 10 years prior, and the other one was just retiring from his career in the military. And we decided to buy a house. It was right over here on Westover, and Entourage was big then, and we wanted to live like Entourage, so we were trying to design the whole house that way. And I remember when we went and looked at the house, it was a nice family, a young family, and they had this one little enclave with these glass windows that, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it was a child's room. And the first thing we did was rip it out and custom make a bar to put right in there. I mean, we were drinkers. We were heavy partiers, and it was fun. And I was working at Baxter's, and my liver just stopped working. I was drinking so much. This is what registered as the beginning of a problem with me. There were probably a lot of things that happened before then, but I couldn't move for 3 days. I was in my bed. My feet, my legs just swollen. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, Blade, but there was a big gluttonous vampire in there, and I had that vision of myself looking like that, just big glob of nothing. And my roommate came in, and he took one look at me. He took me right to the hospital, and they detoxed me. And I remember that then I started thinking, okay, it's not such a good idea to keep drinking the way I'm drinking. I think that's what I got for right now on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, BJ.
My sobriety date is April 26, 2015. I have a sponsor who's taking me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Simple Actions is my home group. I think I started writing sweet promises about 6 years before I had my last drink. I can remember going to a party and getting mad at my husband, and I decided to chug a half a liter of vodka and try to beat him up in front of our friends. He didn't talk to me for a couple days. I think most men would have left, but my husband is Lois Wilson. And he stuck around, and when we finally had a conversation, we decided that I should probably stop drinking. And that lasted about 3 days. And it's kind of funny. In the last years of my drinking, there up at the end, I would have told you that my drinking was only unmanageable the last couple years. But it's funny, coming into AA and doing some reflecting, my drinking was out of control for almost a decade, and you don't see it like that. But as far as waking up after a blackout, you guys know it's the worst feeling in the world. I don't think that normal people, non-alcoholics, ever feel the sense of regret, pain, remorse, guilt, shame that we do after periods like that. And we do it over and over and over again. And I can remember one time I woke up in a Kroger parking lot in my running car about an hour from my house. It was daylight, and the last thing I remember was partying with my friends at Virginia Beach. One time I woke up at a friend's house and realized that I was supposed to be taking care of my boss's elderly dogs, and at that point they'd been on their own for the better part of the day without food or medication. One time I woke up in the middle of an intersection at the oceanfront with my husband trying to coax me into his car before the cops came around the corner. The last thing I remembered was drinking with my new coworkers, and my husband was supposed to be in Newport News, so that was weird. And I woke up like that a lot, and those occurrences became more and more frequent the longer I drank. And you guys have to understand, the last couple years of my drinking, I left my job as a bartender to get a daytime job in my field. I got married. I did all these things to try to control my drinking. And these wake-up calls still got more and more frequent. And that's the unmanageability we're talking about. And unfortunately, that needed to happen. But we'll talk about this more later. Most people wouldn't let that happen more than once. But surprise, the alcoholic doesn't really have a choice. As far as laughing at genitals and cocksureness, that didn't really happen for me until I got the self-knowledge bit. So I'll talk about that in the next paragraph. But there was one other note ahead. The line where it says, as the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, from Bill's story. The first year that I read that, I thought what he meant was he had already taken the drink and the effect was like filling his head. And it wasn't until recently I realized he means he hasn't even drank it yet. He's just putting it up to his mouth. And that's important for me because to me that signifies that sick mental twist. This man hasn't even taken the drink yet, but he already knows he's going to. And that is unique to an alcoholic. So I know that's kind of random, but it bears weight for me. So thank you.
Thank you. That was really nice. Okay, we're going to move to page 7. And it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or asylum.
Yeah. So the jig was kind of up with me. I remember I had the doctor sitting. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. They completely detoxed me. And I remember that the second day I was there, they had to actually drain fluid out of my body. And I'm talking about liters. I was sitting on a table and they had 2 tubes on each side of me. And it was, and I was laughing. And I don't know if I was laughing because it was funny or if I was just delirious or what have you. I remember laughing and I remember her giving me this disgusting look. And I remember the doctor at the end of my bed after all this experience was over and he looks at me, he goes, Mr. Wallace, and I'm not used to being called that. He goes, Mr. Wallace, you keep drinking the way you're drinking, you're going to be dead in a year. And he's like, you don't have cirrhosis yet. He goes, but you have a fatty liver and this is the first stage. And I remember looking at him, and I remember honestly, I was crying, and I remember, I'll never drink again, and I meant it. And you know, it was brought to my attention when I was talking about this the other day, that I could probably pass the lie detector test. I believed it without question, I believed it. And I don't know about laughing at Jim Mills. I had, at that point, is when I became aware of AA. I woke up, and there was a preacher next to my bed, and it's actually I think Preacher Wynn is what I call him, my home group's church. He's the preacher there, and he took me to my first home or my first meeting, which was West Ghent, and I had an airplane bottle in my sock when I went into that meeting, and I didn't had the fortitude. I didn't want to quit drinking. I don't know how to explain it any other than that. I didn't, there wasn't that, hey, this has got to stop. Everybody was telling me it had to stop. I didn't want to stop. I just didn't want to stop. I didn't know what my life would look like without alcohol. I remember people talking about it, and I remember thinking, I don't understand it. I don't get what you're talking about, because what am I going to do without alcohol? How am I going to live without? I'm a bartender. This is my livelihood. And all the good stuff that had happened, I thought, was revolved around alcohol. And as a fact, it was my downfall. But I just, I remember those thoughts when I came in. And you guys were so patient with me. I would have never, ever, ever gotten sober if it weren't for the fact that you guys were like, yeah, we understand. Just keep coming back. And putting your arms around me in those conversations in the parking lots, you know, when some of you cared enough about my life more than my feelings and would tell me things like, you know, Johnny, why don't you give it a try? If you don't like the results, we'll refund your misery. That's all I got for right now.
Thanks, John. In alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. When I was a little girl, my mom and dad told me that I could do anything I put my mind to, and I actually found that to be true in almost everything except for drinking and putting it down. And that just had me baffled for years. I tried and tried and tried to moderate on my own and go it alone, and it just never happened. And I, you know, it was the first time I could not will myself to do something or to not do something. And that just was crazy to me. And I think really that's crazy to the non-alcoholic, but we know better. As far as self-knowledge goes, so I'd say probably the better part of a year before I came to AA, I went to a psychiatrist who told me to go to AA, and of course I didn't. And finally, I got so desperate that I did come to a meeting, and I went to the Bayview meeting at Talbot, the beginner's step study, I think the first three steps, and I heard three different people tell my story, and I never knew that I wasn't alone. I never knew there were other people who drank like me. And, you know, there was so much hope in that. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, this is such a relief. I finally know I'm an alcoholic. Unfortunately, knowing or identifying as an alcoholic is not the same thing as completing the first step. I left that room and thought, okay, now that I know I'm an alcoholic, I won't drink. This is great. You know, my life's going to get better. Then go to another meeting. Then ask for a sponsor. Didn't call anybody. And I made it 2 weeks without drinking, which is the longest period of sobriety I've ever had without help. And, you know, finally, my husband and I went to a wedding reception, and I pulled him aside, and I said, I think I'm going to have two drinks. And he was like, okay, you think you can do that? And I said, absolutely. And every time that man turned a corner, I threw another drink down my throat. And I was like, well, it's going to be different this time. You know, I'm good. So that went on for a couple months. And I finally, it got too heavy again. And I came to this meeting and met some wonderful women. And went out and did the same thing. And, you know, again, didn't ask for a sponsor or anything, but got my head full of knowledge, and I knew I was good. And I went out, and I got to tell you, those few months of last months of drinking were the worst I'd ever experienced. It was terrible knowing that you have a problem, but still doing it. It is insanity. So the self-knowledge thing didn't work. I knew I was an alcoholic like my grandma. I believed it, but I did not think I was powerless. I thought there was still a little bitty possibility that I could control it, and it was worth the gamble for me at that point. As far as having to give myself over to the Undertaker, I didn't have any experiences like Johnny. I didn't end up in a hospital. I think I would have eventually, definitely. But I love to drive drunk, and near the end, I was blackout I never put my hands on my husband again after the time that I mentioned, but I kind of turned that violence inward, and I would wake up after blackouts and would have harmed myself. So I think, you know, just because really you get to a point where you don't want to be alive anymore. So it's a really dangerous place to be. So either way, you're going to die, you know. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Let's go on to page 24. I'll move ahead a little bit. All right. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Yeah. Yeah. So at this point, I was hiding alcohol, and I wasn't used to that, and it was a blow to my self-esteem, because I was a bartender, and at this point, I'm no longer employed. There's nobody that's going to trust me around their alcohol or their money, and I had devised what I thought was a really, really cool scheme. I had airplane bottles would fit, if you pulled up my dresser drawer, it would fit right in between. And they came in 12 packs. I was a big fan of Rumplemintz. I don't know if you guys know what that is. But yeah, it's 100 proof liqueur. And I could fit literally 12 in each side. And, you know, I was unemployed, but like I said, my two best friends were not. They had to go to work every day. So I could get it. The problem was getting rid of the empty bottles. Anyway, regardless, I would literally organize my whole life around this. I would stay sober during the day. And it was a fight, and I didn't always make it. And then at night, I would start drinking when it was time to retire to our own rooms, however you want to put it. The earlier the better. I would retire early, 7 o'clock. I'd be in my own room drinking, in the dark, pathetic. And it was very, very dismal for me. And it was a really nice house, and I used to drag all the cleaning materials out. And I was going to clean, and I would start, you know, polishing shelves, taking all the books off the shelves or whatever, because the living room was nothing but shelves. And I had to get a ladder to get the top. I don't know if you know this, I'm not very tall. But I would get a ladder, and I'd pull it out, and I'd start polishing books and putting them up, and I would start thinking, you know, now's a good idea for a shot. Now's a good idea for a shot. Well, I'll just have one. I'll just have one, just to calm my nerves. And I would have that one shot that lead to two shots, to lead to four shots. And then I would turn around and I would look at the clock, and it's like, they're going to be home in 2 hours. I can't cover this up. And it would be an instant fear. And I would always disappear and then, you know, sober up, not drink, and come home and say I went to an AA meeting or what have you, and then drink again in the dark. And this went on for a while until one day I get a call. And it's a girl's voice in the living room is calling me. I was upstairs in my room. And it was a girl I was dating. And I come downstairs, and I get halfway down the stairs. And there's her, there's the preacher Wynn, there's my two roommates sitting on the couch and then a couple of chairs. And I hadn't seen enough TV shows to know what an intervention was when I came halfway down the steps. And there was alcohol in my room, and I couldn't come up with an excuse to get back up because I knew I needed a shot if I was going to deal with that. I remember thinking that. I just could not come up with a reason. And I come downstairs, and there wasn't really much of an intervention. There wasn't even negotiation. It was, you're going to rehab, you're going right now. And there's no time to pack. We've already packed your bag. You're leaving right this second. And they drove me to rehab. And it was literally just Ed that drove me. He was my closest friend. And he's a funny guy. He's a loud guy. You would love him. And yeah. And there was a pin drop on that car ride. There was no talking at all. And I just remember looking at him and thinking to myself, I don't understand what the big deal is. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Why do you guys care? Why do you guys care? leave me alone and let me drink the way I want to drink. And I mean, I can say drink the way you want to drink now. Then I didn't know. I just remembered I just wanted to be left alone. And I remember that there was these doors that you went in. They took me to Rubicon in Richmond. And there was these doors that you went in, and there were glass doors, and they shut. And there was a clicking noise. And I was like, oh, I'm so screwed. And I was there for 35 days. And it was interesting. They would get us up at 6 in the morning. And it was funny. They didn't really do any research. I was scaring the crap out of my friends. They didn't do any research on it. And it wasn't really even alcohol. It was a drug rehab place. They had one AA meeting on Friday night. So they would wake us up at 6 in the morning to clean, which I thought was extremely unfair because if you guys don't know this or not, I'm very arrogant. Have a 5-minute conversation and you'll realize it with me. But anyway, I was so mad that they made us clean because I thought, you know, I'm paying for this, which I think they paid for it. And then they would take me to trigger classes where you would learn what the trigger is. And the first on my list was always women. Women were always my triggers. You know, if you get me around a cocktail waitress, I'm going to drink. Women are the devil. I remember that my counselor was a woman, and she looked at me. She goes, you have women issues. I was like, you know, you're right. I'm not a drug. I don't get women issues. And they're talking about, you know, you're hearing people talk about heroin. And heroin was the big one in there and everything else. And to be honest with you, I never even saw what heroin looked like until I was there. I mean, it's funny, but it's a fact. It's a truth, and it was weird, and it was a 30-day lockdown. Let's just put it that way. I didn't drink because I didn't have access to it. The guy that offered me heroin in there, I remember I looked at him and was like, I'm not interested. There's a whole story behind it. Ask me another time, I'll tell you. And I left, but I've often thought if that guy had Rumple Mints in his hand, there was nothing stopping me. There would have been nothing stopping me from taking that. That's really all I have for this point.
Thank you. This is secondhand. I heard a speaker share one time that it's been proven that if a woman could bring into her memory with sufficient force how painful childbirth is, that she would never have a second kid. But you know that's not the case because you see women all over the place with more than one kid. And basically what happens is over time the memories of that pain fades. It's the same reason, you know, when you have your first breakup when you're 16 and you feel like you're never going to be able to pull yourself out of bed again, and then 2 years later you don't even remember it. Same thing. So that's kind of how I have to think about alcoholism and all those crazy, you know, terrible wake-ups. I wake up, I feel terrible, and a week later it never happened in my mind. So what that tells me is I'm screwed. Sorry for lack of a better term. That's it. I have no defense. And what I've learned from this program is that I need a spiritual solution because nothing I do is working. I've tried everything. And that has worked for me so far. I've gotten that from this program, and honestly, it's the only thing that I ever did. So that's all I got for now.
Thank you. All right. So we're going to move to page 34. All right. So for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to seize forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking?
I can't tell you how many times I've had people that truly cared about me just look at me and go, man, why don't you just stop? Why don't you just stop? I got out of rehab, and the worst possible thing that could happen to me happened to me. I hear a lot of people share this in meetings. They'll say, you know, when I got out of rehab, I was expecting a parade, and everybody laughs. I kind of got a party. It was funny. There was no alcohol, but all my friends were, you know, I came home. I had my certificate. That thing actually went on the refrigerator, I swear to you. If I'd have thought about it, I would have framed it. And I was sober. I was clean, and everybody was telling me how great I looked, and it was amazing. And I remember that Ed had, we were talking in the kitchen and everybody was out in the living room, and Ed was talking to me. He goes, look, man, he goes, I just want you to know that you know, I love you like a brother, but this is it. It wasn't it. I tested that to the limits, but he's like, this is it. He goes, you know, he goes, I'll always try and support you as a friend. He goes, but this is, you'll be breaking up the kind of family that we have if you drink again. And I remember I looked at him right in the eye, and tears come into my eyes again, just like with that doctor. And I said, oh, I'll never drink again. I just won't do it. And a couple of days went by. And this I remember vividly. And I knew I couldn't. My watering holes were like Baxter's, Scotty Quick's, you know, the nightclub places. I wish you could have seen me. You know, I would get off work, and there would be a line of people trying to get in these places, and my little gray-haired butt would just walk up, fist bump the security guard, walk right in like I owned the place, and I would drink. And I wanted those days back again, and I had no idea how to even begin to start it. And I didn't think about getting a sponsor. I didn't think about doing these steps because either it looked way too difficult or it looked too easy, and it wasn't going to work for me. And I wanted one of those memories back, and I walked down Granby. I didn't drive. I didn't drive for 20 years. It's not because I did anything wrong. It's just it would interfere with my drinking. You got car payments, insurance payments. I was a well-popular bartender. It wasn't because of my personalities. I was a heavy tipper. That money went to the bartender's pockets. So I walked past Scotty Quick's, and I walked past Baxter's. I'm walking down Granby Street. My pace is getting quicker, and I'm looking for a place I can go that I won't be seen. And I go past AJ Gator's. And I looked in the glass door, and there was a bartender working that I cannot tell you how many free drinks I had given this woman when she came into my bar. And I walked in, and I sat down, and I ordered a cheeseburger. It's just like that story, I think, that we're getting ready to come up to. And I waited an attorney, which was at least under 3 minutes, and I asked for a shot. And she looked at me, and she goes, Johnny, I can't do that. You see, Baxter and Ed had thought enough of me that they went to every bar in a walking radius and told every bartender that you're killing it. You know, I sometimes I forget how privileged I really am to have people that cared enough about me to do that. Because they literally walked everywhere and told everybody. I mean, word just went around. And I looked at her, and I was like, come on, Breezy, just give me a shot. And I remember she looked at me, and she just... I've gotten this look from women many a times, but never over alcohol. It's just utter disgust. And she just looked at me and she said, why don't you just get out of here? And I have to tell you, it's one thing to know you're an alcoholic, but it's the first time to my memory that I was treated like one. Mm-hmm. And I remember I walked out of there and I was stunned. And I had a couple of choice words. I didn't just walk out of there. I'm sure there was a couple of finger movements and FUs in there. But anyway, I stumbled out and I didn't know what to do. And I cut a left. And there was the mall, and I walked in the mall, and I was like, Kincaid's is right there on the left. And I walked to the doors, and I looked to the left because the bar was right there. You could see it. And the bartender, I knew her. I'm not going to tell her name. I'm recording, but she was right there, and her back was to me. And I remember I didn't want to go through that again, so I kept walking straight, and I took a left, and there's a little enclave of seats, and I sat down. And I'm so mad. Why didn't she just give me that freaking drink? And this guy walks by with his girlfriend or his wife or whatever. I don't know what he did, but she was really giving it to him. And I remember laughing about it. I remember thinking, oh, no, glad that's not me. And then it just hit. I was like, that guy's got somebody lucky enough to yell at him. And I'm watching all this life around me. I'm watching people paired up, you know, walking, shopping. I'm seeing business people on their cell phones. And I cannot describe to you how alone I felt, because there's nothing but life all around me. And it seemed like I was the only person on this planet without a smile on my face. I was outside of life completely. And I didn't know what to do, where to go, anything that you guys had told me I wasn't thinking of. And I remember I walked out of that. I stopped at the ABC store. I got some more of the 12 packs of airplane bottles. And I went home and I locked myself in my room. And that was the night that I first started planning my murder. That was the night where I first started thinking about suicide. So on that pleasant note.
You do have some personality. Yes. So my last drunk was by no means my worst. I just got to that point where I was done. And I really attribute it to all those terrible experiences kind of compacting on each other. Eventually, you become hollow. Not to sound, you know, cliche, but you're spiritually bankrupt or you feel like crap. So my last drunk, I'll give you the quick version. It was an average day, went to work, nursed a hangover, went to 7-Eleven, got my Pedialyte for lunch, went back to work, got off, went back to the 7-Eleven, got a 32 for the drive home, got in the shower with a couple of drinks, got out, conned my husband into going to dinner at Kogan's Pizza where I could get more alcohol. I think we got a pizza, and I only had like two or three craft beers. You know, it wasn't like a huge drunk, but went home, went to bed. And the next morning, I woke up, had to eat some pizza to kind of sober myself up a little bit. And I said, I cannot do this anymore. I cannot drink anymore. I can't not drink. I'm going to a meeting tonight. And I'm going to talk to those nice ladies I met at that meeting, and I'm going to ask for a sponsor. And for me, when it says, we're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop, that was the first time I ever really desired to stop. Those other times when I randomly came to AA meetings, it was because I was scared. It was because I wanted to learn how to drink and how to control my drinking. But I didn't want to stop yet, not 100%. It has to be 100%. So I guess that was my bottom, you know, not the worst bottom. Worst things had happened, definitely, but that's the point. That's when I came to a head. It was my jumping off point. So as far as diagnostics, let's see. This was baffling. Leave it alone. The book mentions if you want to diagnose yourself, you can go to a bar and try some controlled drinking. It also says at some point, when you honestly want to you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. So to me, that's important to take into consideration. Let's see here. In the next paragraph, they read this at 101 a lot, describing some of the mental states that precede a relapse, and they go into trying to drink only beer, only drinking on the weekend, only drinking at home, only drinking out of the home, not drinking on the job, taking a vacation, staying home from vacation, like all these different things that we as alcoholics have tried to stop our drinking. And I went through a period like that. I can remember I had a beach weekend with my mom about a year before my last drink. And we were leaving the beach, and she was going to stay with my husband and me in Smithfield that night. And we went to a happy hour at the oceanfront before we drove home. And, you know, she'd been worried about my drinking. She grew up in an alcoholic home, and I think she saw the patterns, and I had tried to quit before. But, so I felt this need to reassure her. So we went to the bar, and I got some food, because that's why we're there. We're getting appetizers. And I got a beer, and I encouraged her to get a beer. And I said, you know, I finally realized I'm good when I drink beer. And that's all I do anymore. I just drink beer, and that works for me. I'm so glad I finally found it out. found that out. And she was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, me too. I'm glad. So we went home that night, and I poured some liquor into a soda can and was drinking that. And before I knew it, she and my husband were having an intervention with me. And I was so offended. I felt so misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any beer at home. What, like, that's the only reason I'm drinking liquor. Like, if we had beer, I would drink beer. And the only reason I'm using a soda can is because I don't feel like washing a cup. You know, I'm not trying to hide anything from you. You know, I was so offended. I called my dad and whined, and he sided with me because I'm daddy's girl. And, you know, that, to be honest with you, that was the only intervention I ever experienced. But, man, I was so offended. And in hindsight, wow, you know, red flag. But anyway, let's see. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats this time and time again? And what I love is friends who have reasoned with him after a spree are baffled when he walks into a bar. Well, these are the same friends who will say, why don't you just have one? Because they're not alcoholics. And they genuinely think that that's what's best for you. I've had some friends who are probably some of us. And in college, you know, they would wake up with blood trickling out of their ear. And I never once said to them, why don't you just try to have one? Because I think I knew. I wouldn't want to do that. You probably don't either. And for anybody who asks me, why don't you just have one? Here's my answer. Because if I'm having one, the whole evening is going to be about just having one. I'm not going to notice you. I don't care if the president is in that room. All I'm going to be thinking about is how I can convince myself and you guys that I can have more to drink. And something Johnny mentioned that I wanted to comment on was, I think my drinking really, really kicked off when I discovered that I could drink alone. The first time I realized I didn't need to be at a party and I didn't need other people to be drinking to drink, wow, it really took off. Thank you.
Thanks, BJ and Johnny. All right, so we're going to flip forward to page 37. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always a curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened. And just before this is the story about Jim, who goes into the bar to get the sandwich and gets a glass of milk, puts the whiskey in it. So, yes.
Starts work on Tuesday. I love that.
and he's plain. He's normal in every respect, except he has a small nervous condition.
Right. Yeah. I understand that nervous condition. Yeah. That wasn't my last drink by any means. I was suicidal at this point, and I was coming to meetings at this point just to shut those two friends up. And I would always sit in the back row, and I always look at my shoes or whatever. And I remember that I sat in the back row one day, and a guy, he was this big, big, burly guy. And he's kind of really scary looking. He's sitting next to me, and he makes a joke. And we both laughed, and he kind of disappeared. I didn't see him for a while. And he came back. And at this point, I'd gotten to know a few faces, and I'd gotten to talk to a couple of you. And he came back, and there was just a difference. He wasn't sitting on that back row anymore. He was in the front row. And he got a sponsor. And I just watched this guy. I mean, most of you guys know him. He was a home group member here until he moved away. The only way to describe it was he just opened up like a flower. I'm sure that there's no guy that wants to hear that summer. he literally just turned about face right in front of my eyes. He went from an angry, just, I mean, he's a big dude. You would throw him in the room and you would get out of his way. And he just went to a big gentle giant to where when he gave you a hug, he didn't golf you. And that was the first time that I remember I wanted that. It wasn't enough to get me sober at the time, but you guys kept saying, keep coming back. I was a drawn-out process. If there's a slow learner, that's me. And I'm fine with saying this. I am up for anything. I can do anything as long as fear is not attached to it whatsoever at all. And I had to tip my toe in the water, and I had to see exactly, you know, what it was about. And I had the ability and the privilege to watch this guy in front of me just change. And it changed me watching it. And it gave me the hope to do it. That's all I got, thanks.
I was not one of those people who was offended when you guys insinuated that I was crazy. That's the one thing I did know. I had alcoholic thinking as a child before I ever took my first drink. I'm always ratcheted up. I run everything into the ground and break it off short. Nothing is in moderation. And I always kind of suspected that there was something different about me, even as a kid, just going. And I actually went to a therapist before I came to AA, because I knew I was crazy. And, you know, luckily she directed me here, and that was what I needed. And I remember being kind of insulted when she said that, like, that's all you got for me? Like, really? And come to find out, that has a very good success rate, and that's what I needed. Let's see here. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got there, too. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, we're going to jump forward to page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then, and it was a crushing blow.
Crushing blow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice words.
Yeah. During this period of watching this, and I didn't hone in on it until I watched him go through steps. But I mean, I wasn't like, hey, I'm going to watch this guy and watch him, you know, see if it works or not. It's just, I just happened to be around it. And I was the 30-day king at this point. At this point, I could hold off for right around 30 days. 30 days I wouldn't drink. And then something would happen. It really didn't matter. I stubbed my toes. Somebody didn't say yes when I asked him a question or no if that's what I wanted. It didn't matter. I would get drunk. And I knew that as soon as alcohol touched my lips, it was on. It was at least a 3 or 4 day run of nobody would see me. I'd always come back to you guys with an excuse, you know, something happened, you know, I stubbed my toe. It happened like this for a while until one night, at this point, I had gotten kicked out of the house. I had kept his word. I pushed him to such an extent where this is actually, it was funny because it was one of those stints where I took everything out cleaning and I had a shot and that was it. And then I had another shot, and that was it. And then I had another shot. And I was terrified that they were going to come in my room and catch me passed out. So I went in the attic. And I guess I wasn't as quiet as I thought I was. And he thought a burglar was up there. And I wake up to him pointing a 45, because I jumped up, and he was pointing a 45 at my chest. And he looked at me, and he just started crying. He goes, man, it's bad enough watching you kill yourself. I'm not going to be the guy that kills you. You got to go. So I had met some guys in AA, and they had, you know, brought me into their home. And I'm 30 days, you know, talking with these guys, and then I'm covering up, I'm drinking. And I've worked in restaurants. I've worked in fine dining restaurants. I've worked in nightclubs. I've had more fun in nightclubs. But I've drank some of the best wine on this planet. And I say this a lot. It's not a bragging thing. I say that because the last drink that I've had to date came out of a NyQuil bottle. And I finished the bottle, and at this point I'm driving a scooter. Drove the scooter to the store, got a big bottle, and came home. And guzzled half of that, and I turned around and I looked myself in the mirror. And months before this, I was asking questions. I asked this one guy a question. I'll never forget this. And he turned around and he looked at me. I asked him an AA question. And he turned around and looked at me and goes, you know, I've been doing this for so long, man, I don't even think about it anymore. I just do it. And he walked away from me. And I was offended. I was like, who is this guy to tell me to do it? And he was bigger than me too, everybody is. But it was funny. He would come up to me and he'd shake my hand, and I was too much of a coward not to shake his hand. But when he sat down, I would get up and go to the other end of the table and sit down over there because I didn't want to be around him. But I finish a bottle of NyQuil and a half a bottle of NyQuil, and at this point I'm delusional. And I turn around and I look in the mirror. And you ever seen that DUI picture of Nick Nolte? I was giving this guy a run for his money, man. My hair was everywhere. I'm at Jonas at this point, so my eyes are yellow. My skin is orange. I'm shaking. And I remember I looked in the mirror, and I remember, just do it. Just do it. I cannot tell you what the date was on that. To this day, I don't know what that date was. It was a few days before my sobriety date. I just know that September 25th, 2013 was at 10 o'clock in the morning. I called a guy for help. I slept. I DT'd through it. I don't know how I did it. I can only attribute that to God. And I asked the guy for help, and I haven't had a drink since then. Mm-hmm. That's it.
This paragraph references Fred's story, which I think is my favorite because I relate to it. So this guy has a head full of knowledge about himself, and he goes on a business trip after a short period of sobriety. I think it's in Washington, doesn't matter. And he, after he does his thing, he walks into the restaurant in the hotel lobby and decides that he's just going to have one drink, and that turns into multiple. And the next morning, he wakes up and catches his plane and drinks the whole flight home. And when he gets off the plane, he drunkenly meets up with a friendly cab driver, and they drink for like the next 4 days, or actually I think it's more than that, like a week or two. And you know, his family's probably sitting at home like, where is he? I would do that, you know. It's usually 3 or 4 day benders like Johnny was talking about, and actually dog-eared that story. And I wrote on the margin, read this before drinking, among other things, obviously. Talk to your sponsor. But this disease is patient, and from what I've heard, it is very insidious. And it can wait, you know. All it takes is that one moment where you let your guard down. I have come to believe that under the protection of a higher power, you have some defense against that, but I absolutely believe that a drink could be around any corner, and all it takes is one little moment of, I don't even want to say weakness, just, you know, it is what it is. But my experience was that I had to throw myself into this program. I immediately had to get a sponsor and immediately surrendered to every suggestion that woman made. Because I was desperate. I had to get to that point. That's why I love this topic. The unmanageability and the desperation is the reason I'm here alive today. And, you know, it needs to be done rigorously. It's totally worth it. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, and we have our last paragraph on page 43.
Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
HP.
Yeah. 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 And it's funny how God, I call my higher power God because I'm too lazy to call him anything else. It's funny how God works in my life. You know, that Ed, who I've been telling you about all day, I tried to make amends to him, and he would meet me for lunch, and we would talk, and he would just shut me down. He didn't want to hear it. He just didn't want to hear it. And I was sober. I can tell you, it was last year. We went into business together. On Mercy Friday, I was able to go into business with these two guys. We went into business together, and we were at a Ronda Rousey fight. I got a thing for Alpha Girl. I got other issues besides alcoholism. But anyway, we were at a Ronda Rousey fight, and we were outside having a cigarette. And I just looked at him, and he looks at me. He goes, "Man," he goes, "it's good to finally see that, because there's alcohol there, and I had no interest in it, and I was having fun." And he goes, "It's good to see this you." He goes, "I missed you." And I looked at him. I was like, "Ed, how come you never ever let me apologize to you? Why didn't you ever let me, you know, do my amends?" And he looked at me. He goes, "Man, how many times have you told me you were never going to do it again? How many times?" He goes, "Man, I wanted to see it. I wanted to see it." And none of this would have been possible without God. None of this would be possible. My first instructions that I was given to by my sponsor at the time was, you know, "I want you to pray on your knees in the morning and at night." That was it. That read 6162, which I'm still not very fond of. But anyway, I remember, you know, the first prayer, I was on my knees, and I grew up in a church. I prayed all my entire life to get me out of stuff. And the one time that I really, really, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what to say. I mean, it really just came down to, "I'm here. I'm here, and I don't know what to do." And that was enough. And for somebody as far gone as I was, and I was far gone. I mean, I came to you guys not wanting to quit, not wanting any part of this. I was at death's door. There's a lot of you that saw me when I came in. I mean, I had jaundice. I was DTing in meetings and still drinking all the time. I shouldn't be here with you today. I should not. And the only thing that I have is God and you guys and these steps. And just one more thing before I finish. It's that having two drinks and then abruptly stopping. You always see somebody shudder when you say that. For me, to be sober without these steps and without God in my life makes me shudder. I just can't do it. I couldn't go a day. I know that. Thank you so much for letting me.
Yeah, I love what Johnny just said. That's the same thing for me. His defense must come from a higher power. God gives that to me through sitting in a meeting and hearing other people share about their unmanageability and just quivering. And, you know, certain things that I had forgotten about happening, hitting me all at once, full force, and just, you know, breaking down into trembling tears. I need that. I need those memories. God is able to put into my memory with sufficient force sometimes. And I love it. It hurts when I'm thinking about it. But I am so, so thankful that I'm able to still feel that. And the reason it sucks so bad to relive is because my life is so darn good today. I've never known what this feeling is. I've never known what it's like to be content and still for the first time in my life. You know, this program and my higher power gives me everything that I didn't know I needed. Life is wonderful today. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you to both of you. I'm just so grateful that you guys could be here with us tonight. Let's give them a big round. Thank you. Thank you. Onto our little wrap up business. We have our basket, which is the pass with the seventh edition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup and central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And are there any announcements at this time? Any announcements? All right. And the Simple Actions group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Would home group members please raise their hands? Awesome. Strong. And newcomers, you guys truly are the most important people here this evening, even in front of our speakers. We'd like to take a moment to get to know you. Would you please raise your hand and introduce yourself by your first name only? Anyone here in the first 30 days of sobriety?
Melissa,
I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Melissa.
Welcome.
I'm Chris, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Chris.
Chris. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. All right, well, so glad both of you are here tonight. There is literature available. There are some newcomer packets. And, of course, big books that set on the table over there. The books are the only thing that are sold at cost. Everything else on the table is free. And you can just see a home group member if you wish to purchase anything or have questions. And the sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. Great. So if anyone needs a sponsor, you can talk to one of these people, or feel free to come up to the table after the meeting. I'll be happy to answer questions for you. We do have some information on sponsorship. And I would like to remind everyone, if you smoke, just please move away from the door. There's other meetings. People will be leaving. Just move away from the door when you're smoking and use that butt can out there. And you guys, I would like for all of us to thank Johnny and BJ again for sharing. All right, and we have a volunteer who has agreed to read the last two paragraphs on page 164. Anyone? Quick, draw McGraw. David.
Does this group go to dinner after this meeting?
Oh, yes. You know, I don't see that in here, but yes, this is true. There is a dinner that all of you are invited to. It's at the Plaza del Sol, which is over, just head down Colonial, cross over 21st. It's at the corner of 22nd and Colonial, right next door to the Mambo Room. And we hope to see you all. Get your salsa on afterwards. All right, thank you.
I'm not the holler. My name's David.
Hey, David.
Hey.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right, thank you. And at this time, please join us in closing the meeting with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
All right. Woo! Thank you so much.